So hello everyone, the November 22nd, W3C CCG meeting. Today we have a very interesting, very full agenda. We have a amazing guest, Matthew, join us and talk about the topic of obtaining trust. And then, we also have some other matters to discuss as well. So before we start, I just want to do some quick, IP and call notes. So first of all, just want to remind everyone, the Code of Ethics and Professional Conduct, reminder. There's a link that I sent out in the agenda. More or less, just want to make sure that we be respectful, and acknowledge each other's, opinions. Don't have to agree, but, just make sure that, ensure a psychologically safe environment. All right, a couple of IP notes. Anyone can participate in these calls. However, all substantive contributions to CCG work items must be member of the CCG with full IPR agreement signed. So there's also a link to the agenda sent out. You can click on that to join. Make sure you have a W3C account. If you have any questions, just let one of the co-chairs know. Couple of call notes, the meeting minutes and audio recordings, are available on the W3C CCG website, and we use GT, chat and, to cue speakers during the call. So if you have any questions, just, type in Q plus to add yourself to the queue and Q minus to remove. All right. Any introductions or reintroductions? If you're new to the community or if you are rejoining the community, please feel free to unmute and introduce yourself. All right. At the end of the meeting, I'll call out introductions and reintroductions. So if you're feeling shy and want to prepare a little bit of a couple of sentences, feel free to do so. All right. Announcements and reminders. Kalia, please. Kalia? I think you might be on mute. Actually, I think it might be an audio issue. We cannot hear you. All right, we can come back to Kalia later. Ted?
I just wanted to make a quick note of the Credible Web community group, which seems relevant to today's topic and speaker. Mm-hmm. And anybody who's not familiar with it yet might take a look. I'll put the link in the chat.
Sounds good. Thank you. Thank you, Ted. All right, Kalia. Sorry, I don't think I can hear you. It might be, is it my issue or?
No, I think it's not on your side, Harrison, because I can hear you fine and everyone else fine.
Sounds good. So Kalia, we can come back to you later. Sorry about that. All right. And also, I just want to take a moment to acknowledge the VC API thread, the publication of VC API note thread. In the community. And we invited Brent, the co-chair of Verifiable Credentials Working Group, to kind of share a few words. So, Brent, do you mind share a few words with the community?
I don't mind at all. Folks, there's enough information in that thread for anybody to read who's interested in doing so. I just wanted to, you know, make a statement as one of the chairs. And what the situation boils down to is this. There's a member of the VC working group who has proposed a course of action. There has been discussion about that course of action in the thread. The chairs and our staff contact are in communication with W3 management to determine what the options are for moving the proposal forward within the scope of our charter and W3C process. The chairs have not reached a determination where we stand on that. And but once we do so, we will present the VC working group with those options for them to discuss. I'm happy to take questions, but really that's what it boils down to.
Thank you, Brent. So long story short, we're on it. So thanks a lot. All right, and then I think since Kalia has audio issue earlier, so I'll kind of read her comments in the chat. So she was going to share that we're going to have an event inspired by IAW, APAC Digital Identity on Conference on the March 2nd to 3rd. So with the opening reception on March 1st in the in Bangkok, Thailand. So the if you're in the APAC region or you happen to be visiting there, just feel free to join. Any other announcements or reminders? Manu?
Hi, Harrison. Just wanted to draw people's attention towards a recent post to the mailing list around Google's browser and Fed CM team being interested in exploring native APIs in the browser for Chappie. I'll put a link to that in the chat channel. This is really exciting news. It came out of the discussions that we had with Sam Goto at the Internet Identity Workshop last week. They've got, anyway, we worked through, you know, a plan. There's, an issue raised in the FedCM, group. And this is really about like native open wallet selection in the browser. So, Google's actively, exploring supporting Chappie specifically to do that through the FedCM APIs. I know a number of the chairs were able to kind of chat with Sam at IAW, but I'm just kind of formally bringing it up. Sam would like to come and present to this group about the FedCM work and how Chappie could be integrated into that. And they have asked this group to come and talk about Chappie at the FedCM group, and I'm in communication with those chairs about that. I'll loop the chairs in this group. But just wanted to, say that's a super exciting development from IAW last week. Two, shout out to Dimitri, who has been on this for a while now, trying to make it happen. And three, please read that issue. It's got a lot of exciting screenshots and a native browser demo and all that kind of stuff. That's it for me.
Thank you, Manu, and congratulations. And by the way, which Sam are you referring to? And we can definitely invite him to talk.
We'll put you in touch with him in via email.
Thank you. Thank you, Manu. Any other announcements and reminders? All right, updates on the work items that people want to bring up? Manu, please.
Yeah, just a quick update on the ED, and I still need to chat with the VCWG chairs about this, but in the CCG, we have this Edwards curve digital signature algorithm thing. I put the link in a chat channel to the spec. 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago, we got a first public working draft of the data integrity specification out there. This community had published a crypto suite for the Edwards curve specifically in July, presuming it was going to be pulled into the VCWG working group. I have updated that specification to align with the recent FPWD publication. I don't know at this point, and we'll need to chat about this, in VCWG, if we need to publish another final community group specification because it's lagged so much, or if we can just pull that into VCWG. So just a heads up that there may need to be some more communication between the chairs of VCWG and CCG about this spec in particular and how and when we can move it into VCWG. Hopefully that made sense.
Thank you. Any comments or questions? All right, any other updates on the work items or comments on the work items? Bonnie?
I'm sorry. We just have a lot of specs in motion right now. Status List 2021 is a work item in this community group. There seems to be support to move that spec into VC working group. I have been in touch with a couple of large companies that are still not engaging with CCG, but wanted changes to the specification. We were waiting for those changes to come in. Those large organizations have decided that the specification is okay as is. And so I think that clears us to move that spec into VCWG. The only challenge there being, you know, when we would do that. We have not done a final community group specification publication for that document. We would need to do that. So this is just putting that on the chair's radar as well as something that may need some collaboration between CCG chairs, VCWG chairs, and the editors to make that happen in a timely fashion. That's it. I swear that's the last announcement.
Thank you, Bonnie. Any other updates, comments on the work items? All right, toward the end of the meeting, I'll do a call out for the introductions, reintroductions, and announcements, just in case people haven't had the chance to put that in. Now, let's get to the main agenda. So we're very pleased and kind of honored to have Matthew Glaub, the host of the SSI Orbit podcast and the CEO of Northern Block today, to kind of share his thoughts in regards to attaining digital trust. You know, I've been kind of an avid listener to Matthew's SSI Orbit. I think a couple weeks ago, he actually interviewed Drummond in regards to the difference between the agent and the wallet. And I thought that was a very insightful episode. And then also most recently, he interviewed Stephen Curran on the Anoncrat. So he had the opportunity to actually chat and interview multiple thought leaders in the space. And I thought he could actually use this opportunity to share some of his thoughts in regards to how do we kind of collaborate together to attain digital trust. So without further ado, I'll let Matthew take the floor. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Harrison. Just want to make sure you could hear me okay before I get into it.
Perfect. Thanks.
Okay, awesome. So yeah, thank you very much for having me here today. It is my honor to be here in front of everyone here talking about a subject that we've been thinking a little bit about at Northern Block recently and decided to turn it into a paper. So really the purpose today is to walk you through some of these thoughts. This paper is not done. We're still working through it. I think it's amazing to be able to talk through it with the group here because any feedback that we're able to get and questions whatsoever is definitely what we're seeking and will help us make this a stronger paper. And I hope some of the topics that I discussed today kind of resonate with the group here. And so as Harrison mentioned, I am the CEO of Northern Block. So we're a company based in Canada and I should be sharing my screen now. If I'm not, just let me know. You should be seeing the PowerPoint slides.
Yes, we can.
Awesome. So, we're a company that, I founded in Toronto in 2017 at the time, really doing a lot of software development in the blockchain crypto space. We pivoted towards digital identity or decentralized identity in 2019 because all the solutions that we were really building had a gap in them. We were trying to build these decentrally governed systems, but there was never a really elegant way to onboard users to the ecosystem or to the network. And if you had compliance needs or you had access management needs or whatever your needs were, there wasn't a really good way of doing it without adding some federation. And it was kind of taken away from what we were trying to do. And so that got us really going down the rabbit hole of the centralized ID. And we got quite excited about where the standards were at across the board, where the architecture was heading. I think when I first got into the blockchain space, everyone was trying to stuff everything onto a blockchain. And so it was kind of refreshing to see the movement away from blockchain and just really talking about a different problem that we're trying to solve and then discussing whether or not blockchains make sense at all for specific use cases. And yeah, so since 2019, we've been focused on decentralized ID. We mainly operate in Canada. So we're doing some work with both public and private sector in Canada, building digital trust infrastructure. And yeah, just wanted to shout out, there's a bunch of folks on here that either were part of organizing IAW or pushing sessions forward last week or just folks that were there. So that was an amazing event. It was actually the first IAW that I got to go to in person. Beforehand, I had only attended the online ones. And to be honest, it makes me not want to miss another one again. So I was really appreciative of all the thought leadership that was pushed forward there. And I left every day with a headache trying to rest up for the next day to absorb as much as I could. So a lot of interesting topics from DidCom to OpenID for VC to Trust Over IP to Kalia and Lucy talking about MDL here. And as Harrison mentioned on my podcast, SSI Orbit, I try to talk to folks like yourselves just to push the conversation forward towards adoption in the space. And so actually one person that I knew of but hadn't spoken to, Andrew Hughes at that conference, he's one of the next guests that will come on the podcast to talk about MDL. So I'm quite excited about that. And if any of you want to be on or have any topics of interest or whatsoever, please reach out to me after. I could leave my email here after. Actually, Daniela, you're on the call. Maybe you could post my email in the chat and then feel free to reach out to me on Twitter or LinkedIn. Okay, so getting to the presentation here, let me jump into it. So attaining digital trust. And so I'll be talking a lot about public sector or government ID here. It's just, it's a lens that we're familiar with based on the work that we're doing. And I just want to make sure that if sometimes it comes across that this is the only way forward and the only thing that's needed for the success of digital credentials and privacy preserving interactions and relationships online, that's not what I'm saying here. I'm still trying to brush up on some of the language that we're using here. But I start off by talking about kind of gaining national sovereignty in the digital world. So we often talk about self-sovereign and take it from the perspective of individuals, but it's not only for people, right? The sovereignty is also quite important for nation states. And so as democratic nation states maintain or want to increase their sovereignty, it definitely could result in positive downstream implications on the sovereignty as of us individuals inside of these states. So the big first question is, how does a sovereign nation ensure their sovereignty remains in a digital world? And so I think it's clear that tech companies have sovereignty over their digital space. I mean, they architect the rules, the algorithms, the data, versus in the physical spaces where governments are mostly in charge. If we take an example and go back to that January 6th event at the US Capitol in Washington in 2021, the response mainly went to tech companies and not to governments, right? The tech companies were empowered to deplatform the president of the US, and there were other platforms that were kind of taken off of their infrastructure, like Amazon took off Parler, et cetera. And however you feel about these tech companies, or call them social media companies then or today, and there's a lot of divisiveness on this, and Twitter is a good example of this today, but Twitter has digital sovereignty. And we've seen this just in the past few days as they've been reinstating previously banned accounts. So whatever opinion you have about their policies, no one really voted for these rules. They just were able to exert sovereignty themselves. And so nation state sovereignty in the digital world remains a pressing topic. And so in the digital space today, I'll make the claim that the private sector has moved far ahead of government. And again, generally speaking, and we've seen a lot of activity recently. So in early 2021, the prime ministers of Estonia, Finland, Denmark, and Germany called on the EU to speed up digital sovereignty and the creation of a digital single market. And so they wrote a letter, the four prime ministers of these countries wrote a letter that said digital sovereignty means increasing Europe's technological capacity and its ability to establish values and rules in a technology-centered world that's becoming dominated by other countries. And they called on the European Union to get ahead of the curve in this digital transformation. So they talked about putting to effectively safeguard competition and market access in the digital data-driven world, and that critical infrastructure and technologies need to be put in place and need to become resilient and secure. And so since then, we've seen many EU nation states first prioritize nationwide digital ID programs, stuff coming out of the EU and then stuff coming out of the nation states themselves as kind of a first order of action to increase their sovereignty. And so if the first thing kind of they're working on is digital ID to gain digital trust, that's kind of the hypothesis is that leads to sovereignty from them for them. I talked a bit about this on a podcast. I see Tim is on the call here. I did a podcast with Tim and Daryl O'Donnell. I can't remember when, maybe a year ago, but just talking about this a little bit. And so with our economies that are continuing to undergo a shift and a rising share of growth and prosperity is being driven by intangible assets, which is kind of non-physical assets, but ones that have the possibility to generate significant economic value through like examples are like data, digital services, brand equity, marketing, etc. It's really important to start looking at how digital ID needs to kind of have its place in there. And so governments do provide digital ID, not digital ID, but governments provide ID infrastructure and root of trust in the physical world today, right? Like if you want to register a new company, you do so in a corporate registry. They define NAICS codes, which basically authorizes your boundaries of how to operate as a business. Everything's kind of tied to the legal system of the nation state. And the same for individuals, right? We get birth certificates. If you immigrate to a country, you get immigrant land immigration ID. So these are foundational building blocks to enable access to services and goods. And since we spend most of our time in the digital world, at least I know I do, and if I had to make a bet, I'm sure a lot of the folks on this call do as well. I think there's an expectation that government provide the same level of trust online that they're able to do in the physical world. And so if digital trust will bring sovereignty to states and citizens, how do we attain digital trust? So I wrote an introduction last year to digital trust. I shortened the URL here. I kind of saw this a few times at IAW. I thought it was pretty cool. It's a little bit easier to grab it if you're looking at it. But I wrote an introduction to digital trust, just explaining it from a very high level and trying to simplify it. But now I'm trying to move this discussion forward and really answer the question, like, what does it mean to ensure trust is baked into these digital interactions? And so when we talk about the trust triangle, which was covered in this initial post, we use jargon called issuers, holders, verifiers, and that's supposed to exactly map to the world we have today. And we often play these three roles in our day-to-day lives. And again, I don't think I'm teaching anything new to the folks on this call today. So, right, an issuer sends a credential to a holder could accept or decline it, and a holder could then present that credential to whomever they wish with whatever levels of privacy they wish. But within these interactions, there's further questions that need to be asked that kind of weren't asked in that original post. And for every type of interaction, right? Issuer to holder, the reverse holder to issuer, and same thing on this side. So from an issuer standpoint, am I issuing the credential to the right holder? Is the holder authorized to receive the credential that I'm issuing to them? from a holder standpoint, there's all sorts of questions, like, is the issuer who they claim to be? Is the issuer authorized to issue what they're issuing? Same thing as the verifier, who they claim to be. Is the verifier authorized to verify? And all the way to the verifier standpoint, which you could ask questions like, did the issuer issue the credential to the right holder? Is the holder authorized to receive that credential? Is the issuer who they claim to be? Is the issuer authorized to issue what they issued? And these aren't the full lists of questions that should be asked. As you can imagine, we want to know other details about credential types or credential schemas, wallets used. There's all sorts of other questions that you may want to be asking in these interactions. But for the purpose of this, just trying to take that initial paper on digital trust a step further as it comes to the claims being made by answering these three questions here. So one, how could I trust any type of claim that is made digitally independent of my role within the trust triangle? Second question is, what infrastructure is needed to support this? And the third question is, who should build, deploy, and maintain this infrastructure? So we're going to go through these three questions and talk about, hopefully I can provide some answers or steps forward in the next few slides. And again, not all of this is concrete in the thinking, still working through a lot of this. So this is where, again, as I'm walking through, and if anyone has feedback at the end, that would be very valuable. So the first question is, what infrastructure is needed so I can trust any type of claim made digitally? So when an entity is provided with a claim, there's a few things, so three other things now that they want to ensure. One, that the claim hasn't been altered or falsified at any point in time. So that could be at presentation or at any other point in time. Second, that the claim has accurate representation. And three, that the claim is authoritative, that it has authoritativeness. And so I'm not suggesting that you need to follow these three steps. And I think on everything, there needs to be a disclaimer that decisions on digital trust architectures need to always be risk-based. And there's no absolute trust that you're ever going to gain, simply just a level of assurance that's good enough for your risk profile. And so these are suggestions, and based on certain risk profiles, perhaps you want to ensure these three things. And as I'm going through, I'm really only seeing today that the claim hasn't been altered, falsified at any point in time. I think there's a lot of discussions happening, and we saw a lot of them at IAW about these other things here, which is great that we're asking these further questions right now. I think coming back to nation state sovereignty and infrastructure that's being built, really only seeing this happening today. So ensuring a claim hasn't been altered, falsified. So I'm going to go through these three bullets here. So as you all well know, through cryptographic proofs, we are today able to guarantee to a verifier or to any really person in that trust triangle that the claim being presented is based on unchanged data. So we're ensuring that if it's a credential in this case, and the claim being presented to a verifier is the same as the one that the issuer issued to the holder. And there's different implementations of this. At Northern Block, we're quite familiar with the Hyperledger, Indy, Aries, Anoncred's world. We've started to do more work in JSON LD, but just using it within an Aries context, just based on kind of where our market is today and what the demand is for this stuff. But I think as I will repeat later in the presentation, I think, and as Manu, you said that in one of the sessions at IAW, I think we could all agree that we're going to be in a world with different protocols and different technologies that are all kind of playing together based on the use case. But so here really all we're doing is verifying that the claim or that the data hasn't been altered, not really the legitimacy of the data attributes themselves. And so the next question really is, how do I know the other entity in question in a claim is accurately represented? And again, for many of the three roles in the trust triangle. So here I'm claiming, for example, that the credential that I'm presenting has been issued by XYZ. So you may say it's been issued by the government of Ontario. So let me verify that it was actually the government of Ontario that issued it to you. And again, same for any other role in the trust triangle. So we're now starting to verify that the data beneath the claim was issued to the holder by an accurately represented entity, and that the holder was accurately represented as well. So both issuing and accepting parties were duly authenticated. And so this is a problem that exists in the physical world today as well. So if any of the folks here have ever had a fake ID, fake driver's license, you falsely represented who issued a document to you. And having a DID anywhere on Ledger, or however your implementation, doesn't magically solve the issue in the digital world. So how do I know that an issuing organization actually owns and remains in control of that DID? And this is an authentication challenge. And so at the time of issuance, as a recipient, as a holder of the credential, I may have followed different governance models to authenticate the identity of the issuer. There's different methods for authenticating for accurate representation. Again, it depends on the use case, on what's available. We're starting to do more work in DNS security right now. It's a very good implementation for government credentials because you're able to kind of get a guarantee through the root of trust and the DNS certificates that the ownership of a specific domain, such as Ontario.ca, is actually under the current ownership and control of the province of Ontario. And if ever there's a takeover and someone takes over the website, you'll find out about it in the DNS security. And if ever that causes a problem and credentials were issued during that time, you could always go back and revoke the credentials that were issued during that period of time. But there's other use cases where this DNS security is maybe not the way you want to go. And so you could use different authentications, FIDO authentications. You could use Google accounts to authenticate. It really depends. Again, you're playing Legos here, but we're talking about an authentication problem to ensure a claim has accurate representation. So we've kind of taken this a step forward, and now I actually have the confidence here that not only is the claim that the claim data hasn't been untouched, but the entity they're claiming issued that data to them, in this example, is that entity in real life. So I could prove that they actually own the DID, or I could have assurance, not complete proof, but assurance to a certain level that they are in control and own the DID. And so that moves us then to kind of that third level. Now I want to see an implicit claim that I have the authority, or the other party has the authority to do something. So this is the claim that we're trying to resolve now. And so, for example, that the accurately represented issuing entity has authoritativeness to issue such data to such holder. There was a lot of conversations at IAW about how you would go about that. A lot of discussions about lists and the type of information that would be in lists. I think we're starting to think a little bit more how this works for certain interactions, but not for others, how lists could be useful, or trust registries, which is a popular yet it drives confusion term to describe what this does, maybe is a good solution for the issuing side of things, but maybe not for getting authoritativeness on the verifier side of things or even the holder side of things. But that's a whole other discussion. But until you get to this third level, you can't reach complete, and I'll put in brackets, complete relative digital trust in a transaction. And again, there's another podcast I did with Daryl O'Donnell on this recently that you could listen to if you're interested in trust registries. But it's definitely a concept that seems to be growing in popularity. But I envision the user experience of trust registries, or however we want to call this, being similar to your browser telling you that a website maybe is not secure because it doesn't recognize the certificate. So there's going to have to be a little bit of UX built in here. There's obviously conversation about governance as code and other implementations as well. So again, not pushing an agenda on any specific implementation here. And so these three questions come back here, that the claim, so if we have confidence that the claim hasn't been altered, falsified, that the claim has accurate representation and the claim has authoritativeness, it should give us the relative trust to say, this is enough infrastructure that I need to put into place so that I could trust any type of claim that is made digitally. Which leads me to the second question, is what ramp is needed to maximize, or what on-ramp is needed to maximize the benefits of this infrastructure, these three layers that we just talked about. So how could we bootstrap this thing if we have the infrastructure but no digital IDs, or no foundational digital IDs? So it's kind of like you build a road. Give a bit of an analogy to roads here. I like to use that example because roads are infrastructure. It kind of leads into digital identity should be infrastructure. But it's like you build a road, but with no ramps. So like how will cars or trucks get onto the road without the ramps? So the first question that we talked about the infrastructure here, this is kind of more about the roads. And this question here is more about the ramps to get onto the road. So I hope that's a decent enough analogy. But the question becomes what ramps are needed to maximize the benefits of that infrastructure. And so if you look back at a moment in history where after Eisenhower became the president of the U.S. in 53, and he had gotten this idea from looking at Germany's Reich Autobahn system, the highway system, he pushed forward an investigation and then an investment to build an interstate highway system. And this is a quote from the appointed general, General Lucius D. Clay, who was put in this investigation for the highway system, and I think there's a lot of parallels to digital ID here, is that he said it was evident we needed better highways, we needed them for safety, to accommodate more automobiles, we needed them for defense purposes, if that should ever be necessary, and we needed them for the economy, not just as public works measure, but for future growth. And so they started building this interstate highway system in 56, and this is responsible for today's trucking industry, for suburbs today, for gas stations, motels, the road trips. So this national network, this highway system, was built to move goods and people around. And so just like roads are a public good, digital identity needs to be a public good as well. The reliance in our everyday lives on proof of presence, proof of age, proof of address, proof of eligibility, which eligibility to drive or to get healthcare services, these are all driven by government. Differently in different nation states, but they're all driven by government. So these are basically the outcomes of being able to access the road through a ramp, right? And so to access this interstate highway system, or to access this infrastructure, we need foundational digital identity, which is the ramp. And so who is providing the infrastructure and the ramps to the infrastructure? So I'd argue, and again, pulling it back to the start of the conversation about digital sovereignty for a nation, I would claim it's more important or at the same level as a highway system. You need it for safety, you need it for defense, you need it for the economy. It kind of fits perfectly here. One model that I've found very useful in the past, and there's some folks here from the Trust Over IP Foundation, but it's been helpful in the past to kind of walk people through how you would build digital trust infrastructure through this. It's basically a framework that adds a governance layer across the technology side of things. So the governance and policy questions are the ones that need to be answered in order to drive business, legal, social acceptance. Again, it really depends on the governance and the ecosystem you're seeking, but for ecosystems that require legal, business, social governance, it's been a good model. And recently there's been an enhancement to this model, or I don't know if I would call it enhancement, but a new kind of way or framework of looking at digital trust. And it was documented in the new technology architecture specifications. I know Drummond on this call was one of the key folks behind that. But we look at this hourglass model. And so it's based on the hourglass model that is used for the internet. And much of the success of the internet today is attributed to this design, which in which the spanning layer protocol here maximizes interoperability by providing a common way for the higher levels to communicate with the lower levels. So this would be IP v4 in the internet today. And the design of the trust spanning protocol should be very thin, very simple, not get in the way of anything else that could be functions on top of it. What I really like about this model is it makes it more use case and technology agnostic. Like, for example, it's removed the need for public utilities, which was kind of a base layer here, where we would often talk about blockchains, or it even removes the focus on use cases where we know that trust tasks protocols don't have to be credential exchange. They could be all sorts of things, but this model kind of just makes it a little bit more vanilla, and you could kind of apply what you're trying to do, what you're trying to achieve into it. And this was another discussion that was quite interesting at IAW to see how OpenID for verifiable credentials and PSYOP and these types of things could fit into this model. And it seems like there is a nice fit. So it's a nice model. We could get into this, might run out of time, but could get into this in a future conversation. So if I go back to my claim about foundational IDs being the ramp to the infrastructure needed for digital trust, and I map it against this model, I could see that two out of the three supporting systems are not really yet started to support foundational IDs, or at least from our vantage point, we're not seeing them, right? And these were the three things that we're trying to answer of getting cryptographic proofs, accurate representation, and then authoritativeness. There's some good traction in different places in the world around having utilities that allow us to verify cryptographically the DIDs of issuers. So that's why I put it yellow. Like in Canada, there's the Candy network that is implemented across different provinces. In Europe, there's different networks as well. So we are seeing traction here, but not really seeing much traction or standardization across these two other ones. There's a lot of conversations about it, but not really seeing this, if this is truly needed to support foundational IDs. And I think the supports, like the hardware, certain infrastructure, I put this green, like this could be different communication protocols, like DIDCOM is a good example. It maybe isn't fully green yet because it maybe doesn't meet all the criteria, but the point I'm trying to make is this is all pretty defined, mature, done. It's not like a big problem we have to solve for to issue foundational IDs. The foundational IDs here in yellow are kind of in progress, and really without these three things, it's going to be a little difficult to achieve digital trust in the exchange of foundational IDs, which I will claim will be foundational to a lot of our interactions online. So I'm not saying that every DID or identity that exists needs to have a foundational ID behind it. I'm also not saying that like non-government people can't issue IDs. But for certain levels of trust to be there, you need a foundational identity. So it's almost like, would you rather verify my Google account or verify that I have a valid SIN number in a specific country? So this kind of answers what ramp is needed to maximize the benefits of the infrastructure, which takes me to the last question here. We'll be wrapping up shortly. I'll try to leave about 10 minutes for a conversation and questions, and we'll definitely value anyone reaching out afterwards. But the question of who should build, deploy, and maintain this infrastructure. So similarly, I think the reason government has to create the digital equivalent of what they have in the physical world is they need to create the infrastructure and the ramps that we talked about, and the infrastructure being this, and then the ramps so that you could access foundational ID. Government's the source of truth for these things. They offer it today, like I said, as a public good in the physical world. Now they need to do it digitally. It will allow them to protect their sovereignty and enhance the sovereignty of their citizens. It will, should, if built right, give that agency to their citizens in many of their interactions. It'll protect them from frauds, identity takeovers, phishing attacks, all of these things that happen way too frequently today. Every time I kind of go to a cybersecurity conference and see all of the vendors that are selling solutions there, and that whole space is growing like crazy. Although there's more and more money being poured into that space, it's just foundationally not solving the problem. It's like we're trying to stick band-aids on a cut that is way too big. So digital ID is created today by the private sector. I mean, there's different, you could think of different types of IDs, like my email is an ID, my bank account could be an ID, my operating system perhaps gives me an ID, but I don't have a government digital ID. And so if we're talking about, you know, digital interactions and digital transformation, we don't have a foundational ID from the government. I don't see how that makes sense. And so there needs to be a carved out place in the digital world that governments own. Again, in the physical space, there are things they own. And so it's about doing it in the digital space. And the questions here, why won't the private sector build a foundational ID? It's just not in the interest of the private sector to build it. They're not in the business of public good or communities, good for everyone. They do build some infrastructure, like here in Toronto where I live, there is a highway system, 407, that is a toll route. I know there's a lot of toll routes in the US and in other countries throughout the world, but they have a commercial interest, right? They keep the roads nice for profit, to continue making money, not for public good. If I'm going to use like lists or infrastructure as a way to create digital trust, it can't be defined by the private sector. They just have different incentives and there could be biases. And I'm not saying the private sector needs to sit and wait. I mean, knowing how wide to build a road lane can only be known if you kind of know the width of the cars that you need to support. So definitely not saying they should sit and wait. Just saying there needs to be more collaboration, but the infrastructure that I'm talking about today should be driven by public sector. And then why big tech shouldn't build it? Well, this is where I mentioned Andrew Hughes on the MDL side. I'm just curious to go a little bit deeper into some of, and maybe Lucy and Kalia with your work on MDL would be interested to just know a bit more kind of about some of the context and the walled gardens that Apple is able to apply, and Apple basically telling governments what to do because government doesn't own it. And this really definitely impacts their sovereignty, which is the whole reason why governments are investing in digital ID programs. So big tech shouldn't be doing it. And then why kind of non-for-profits or communities? I don't think open communities are driven towards consensus for a specific country. Like, they're global, which is positive in many aspects. They're principle driven, which is amazing in different aspects. But sometimes it's also tough to have timelines and specific mandates. It's more general, not for a specific nation state. And so that's why I get to the end here, which is still being worked on. But why does it make sense for government to build this infrastructure? Well, because it's infrastructure, it cannot monetize itself independently. It's an investment which only the government can make. And because it's not a use case, it enables the use cases to be driven by the private sector, mostly in an unbiased, decentralized environment where there's not any proprietary biases. So this is where we think, and governments are building this and working towards it. We're just trying to paint kind of what else needs to happen and who needs to build, deploy, and kind of maintain this infrastructure that we're defining here. And again, I think everything is about adoption, business use cases, and we really feel like this is a crucial piece to build and why the government should build it. And once they do, we feel like adoption will just automatically happen like it has on the highway systems. And so, with the taxpayer money we pay, and I don't know, 90% of the time during the day that is spent in the digital space, I think there's more value we could get for that. So there you go. I'm at the end of this presentation. There's 9 minutes left. I'm going to stop here. I hope this was interesting or enjoyable or both. And I welcome questions and feedback. And thank you.
Adrian? Thank you, Matthew. Adrian?
Yeah, this was interesting and enjoyable. Foundational ID typically in the non-digital space involves biometrics, but you did not mention biometrics at all in this presentation, at least not that I heard. And I'm sort of curious, as you envision this digital public good, which I completely agree with you, what do we as a tech community have to do relative to biometrics in order to promote your vision?
I will say that I'm not the right person to answer this. I would love to work with folks that are more familiar with the space, because I'm not, and we don't spend much time there. But I think it's an area that was missed and should be touched on, but I don't have any answers right now.
Thank you. David?
Yes, I'm just wondering how governments assigning these digital IDs to people conflicts with, or how you reconcile it with, Kim Cameron's fourth law of identity, which states that public bodies should have omnidirectional identifiers, but that people should have unidirectional identifiers.
Yeah, I guess same comment. Not familiar with that. We'll need to go look and see if it conflicts with what I said here. But this is something that we'll definitely have to go look at. I think there's one of the, I think Tim Boma, you had shared that on Twitter yesterday, like the, just a list of resources and stuff. I think we often just struggle to align everything all together and incorporate everything, but that's something that we'll definitely look at as well on top of the biometrics.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Matthew. That was a really interesting presentation. I'm curious, though, about your analogy to the highway system insofar as the parallel to that digitally, of course, is the internet. Not necessarily the web, but the internet. And it was funded largely by federal funding with support from federal agencies, but in collaboration with private sector. And to this day, it is principally run by the private sector. And so I'm curious how the analogy stays together or whether there is something distinct in the digital world which opens opportunities for other players to have an ongoing role.
That's an interesting comment. I'll have to think about that one as well. I don't have, I'm trying to form the right analogy. Probably not perfect so far, but we'll have to include that as well.
And Matthew, I have a clarification question. So earlier you mentioned that government should be building the identity infrastructure because it's a public good. Now, just to clarify, are you referring to government building the issuance infrastructure as an issuer and or trust registries or verifiable data registries and or wallet and or like verifier infrastructure? Like, are you referring to the entire infrastructure or just talking about a certain parts of it?
I'm not necessarily talking about the solutions that are used to execute the trust tasks, whether it's the issuance of a foundational ID or whatever it is. I think it's just the governance around these things. And part of the governance that I was like having a verifiable data registry to manage governance around who could issue what type of thing on this network. That's kind of one of those supporting pieces. But there are other supporting pieces of how authentication should be done based on different risk profiles, and the same thing with how authority should be established. These are the types of governance pieces that, when I say they need to own, not necessarily own the end implementation of it, but own the architecture and the design of it, and then the rules around it. I know there's push in different jurisdictions, like the EU, for example, that nation states will each push their wallet forward. I'm not convinced that that is the approach that is going to be a long-term approach for the growth of this stuff. I think that we're seeing a lot of nation states push their own wallets forward just because they're trying to figure out where their boundaries are and what they want to control and what they don't want to control. I'm not saying in this presentation that governments need to own the wallets, need to own the issuer services and stuff like that. Again, it's contextual to what the government wants to do, but I don't think that that is the crucial piece in establishing digital trust with a foundational ID.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yeah, I just want to make a comment. I think, Matthew, you bring up good points and raise good questions, like, especially the questions around accuracy, like, hit a chord with me because, as Spokio, we are trying to determine data truth and accuracy. And the truth is you cannot, actually depend on one single issuer, like even government agencies, like, for example, birth information, government agencies has different, accuracy levels, and historically it's been established that DMB is the best source, right? Not SSN, and things like that. So I thought the accuracy question is, quite important and very, very thoughtful for this entire community to think about. Because if accuracy and truth is just what the majority says, like in blockchain, then the earth will always be flat, because at some point in human history, the majority of human race believe that earth is flat, right? So I think it is a very, very good question. And I think it's a very thought-provoking question for myself, and I think for a lot of us.
Yeah, and I appreciate the questions. I think this still trying to figure out. I feel like there's good things being talked about in this paper. Just there's some things that need to gel better together. But I really appreciate we're going to consider how biometrics. Thanks, Adrian, for that. How that fits in, and then the Kim Cameron laws of identity fits in, and even the road analogy of maybe at times it was rightly used or wrongly used, but just to make sure. If we're using that analogy, that it's it fits tightly to what we're trying to say.
Cool. Thank you. So we only have about 2 minutes. So I just want to say thank you again, Matthew, for sharing your insights and your upcoming paper. You raised very good questions, and I just want to take a moment to thank you for taking the time to present at W3C CCG.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me here. I was lucky to present to the group here. So thank you very much.
All right. So any last introductions, announcements, reintroductions, or reminders? Okay. So I think a quick preview of what's coming. So next week we'll have open discussions around decentralized social media. I'll send out the agenda. There's a little change in the agenda. We'll have the plug fast recap in the beginning of January. And then next week we'll have, decentralized social media discussions. And then the week after that, we'll have Emil John, to talk about the use of VCs and deeds, in the government. All right. Thank you. Have a good one. Bye. Right. And happy Thanksgiving to those in the States. Thanks.